All of the major events of the first half of the 19th century in America, the Louisiana Purchase, the Florida's becoming part of America, the Missouri Compromise, obviously, the war with Mexico that gave us California, the additional states here and there, all of that seems to fall back on this issue of slavery. There's also stuck in there the War of 1812 and the events preceding it. You devote a great deal of your book, Gary Wills, to an event called the embargo, which was set up by Jefferson, and it seemed to be a precursor to what eventually became the War of 1812. What was the embargo? And an embargo would tend to hurt, I would think, the South more than the North.
Well, actually it did, but it was not intended to. When the relations with England became so tense that there was an outcry for war when the British fired upon the Chesapeake, an American ship, and killed American sailors, Jefferson, who did not want to go to war, and Gallatin, his treasurer, who said, "We don't have the means to go to war," said, "All right, we'll punish England. We will slap an embargo on all trade." And, of course, that hurt, first of all, and most obviously, New England, because that was the trading area. It put their ships in harbor and ordered them not to go out, not even for coastal trade, not even to go down to Charleston or something like that. Now, reflexively, of course, that did harm the South because they couldn't ship their goods out. On the other hand, he thought that they were more self-supporting in terms of they raised enough to eat their own food and make their own clothes. It did come back and haunt them, but he thought it was going to be more a punishment of the Anglophile commercial North, and that's the way it was conceived in the North, and that it would help the agrarian slave culture. So Pickering was one of his most scathing critics on these grounds, that it was an exercise of the slave power to crush the northern enemy of the slave power. So even that had to be read through the filter of slavery. You know, you already mentioned the Mexico War. The Mexican Republic had abolished slavery. We reimposed it. We didn't just take over a territory that was neutral. We took over a territory that had realized that slavery was wrong, and we reinserted it. Ulysses Grant, who fought in that war, said that was the great sin for which the Civil War was the punishment.
One other subtext here that I kept coming up with, and as we know more about, I guess we'd call it the current revisionist trend toward looking at the, quote, founding fathers, we see that, in fact, all of these wonderful things in the Constitution came out of these political battles, and that these people were no more or less moral, honest, whatever, as people today, though, of course, they were in, you know, different society.
They were noble. They did have noble ideals. Jefferson certainly did. They did extraordinary things. The religious freedom, for instance. No society had had a separation of church and state before ours. That's an extraordinary achievement. Washington is, I think, unquestionably the greatest American leader. To say that they were flawed is, you know, not to say that they were not great people. You know, it's a little bit like we as individuals, as we grow up, realize that our parents had all kinds of flaws, but that doesn't mean they're not revered as our parents. And we as a nation, I think, should have the same attitude toward our past leaders. They are our forefathers, foremothers, and they had a lot of flaws, but that doesn't break our link with them. In fact, it's a tie to them because we have some of that ourselves.
What they did, particularly in the Bill of Rights, is absolutely extraordinary and remains absolutely extraordinary. But when I see the so-called strict constructionist judges bringing up the forefathers' intent, and when we discover that the forefathers' intent was interrelated with slavery.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, there are all kinds of problems with that intent business. For one thing, of course, the people who subscribed to the Constitution had many different intents, many different motives, and we don't go by their motives. We go by what they wrote. And what they wrote was deliberately open-ended. You know, Madison says in The Federalist that every law has to be tested and adjusted to reality. So if you want an original intent, there's the original intent of Madison that says this is a law that's it's a guideline, really, that's got to be adjusted to the future realities. But go back to the idea of them as models for us. In some measure, they were. It was an extraordinary society. You know, John Kennedy said to Arthur Schlesinger, what brought together all these geniuses at the Constitutional Convention? Well, they weren't geniuses, but they were extraordinary people, partly by circumstance. They were the cream of the crop. And at that time, it was easy to get a few people who could embody all the values of society. The encyclopedic ideal of the 18th century, that a man could really know just about everything, was alive and well. Samuel Johnson, David Hume, Diderot, these were encyclopedic minds, and so was Franklin, so was Adams, so was Jefferson. Now, of course, the specialized knowledges that we have now, to get their equivalent, we'd have to have the best scientists, the best university presidents, the best religious leaders, the best doctors. You know, you had doctors there, you had a religious leader like Witherspoon. And also, in a privileged society, those at the top have drawn a lot of the powers and wisdom of the society into themselves and deprived others. The mere fact that some Southerners were so important, one of the advantages of slavery is that to be a good plantation owner, and there weren't too many, you really did have to be a political master. They ran kingdoms, you know, thousands of acres, hundreds of souls. They were the health and welfare minister. They were the economic planner. They were the disciplinarians. They were the police. They were the State Department of these kingdoms. So it was like princes from little fiefdoms in Europe. If they came together and traded their knowledge on how to manage things, delegate things, plan things, they'd have a great deal of expertise. So a lot of that was a kind of offshoot of what was bad in the society. That's the trouble with history. Everything that comes up has entangling good and bad in it.
Your book ends in the periods leading up to the Civil War with some looks back from Henry Adams. What in the 1850s changed to such a degree that suddenly the system fell apart?
For one thing, of course, the anti-slavery movement was gathering international steam at that time. The abolitionists were making great strides, all despite the fact that the South had tried to marginalize them and had in great measure. The movement west was probably the principal problem. The pressures to go west, pressures economic and every other kind, had built up so that fighting over Kansas, Nebraska, Missouri, etc., became a war, you know, the Kansas War and John Brown and things like that. Compromise after compromise had failed by that point. And so even you get somebody like Lincoln, he's trying to compromise. You know, he's saying, we're not going to challenge the slavery in your states. We're going to only keep it out of the territories. And Lincoln said in the Douglas debates, I don't mean we should have intermarriage. I don't mean that the blacks should vote. I don't mean any of those things. I just mean don't own people in territory where they weren't owned before. And he had, as he always did, these wonderful illustrations. He said, I won't like the fact that my neighbor allows snakes to get into the bed of his children. But if he does, I can't do much about that. I can't go over and kill the snakes myself. But if we're building a new territory and we put up a new house and we put up a new bed and we go and put snakes in the bed, that's what we have to stop. That's the kind of argument he used with juries. He could make things just crystal clear. But, of course, even that, the South despised and hated him because he had taken even that step. And he was trying to hold things together. His law partner was a great friend of the abolitionists and always tried to get Lincoln together with them. And he said, no, I'm not going to have anything to do with those folks, because he'd never have been elected president. Cairo in Illinois is about as far south as you can get and not be in Alabama. And so when he spoke down there, he spoke in a very different tone. So all of these attempts to hold the thing together, one by one, had failed. And the pressures were just building and building so that even Lincoln's cabinet was divided on whether to compromise of the South, whether to strike a deal with the abolitionists. You had the fight of Seward and Sumner. Lincoln was sitting on top of a divided cabinet as well as a divided country. And clearly, that couldn't go on. It had to have some kind of resolution. And there was no other, apparently, but war.
One final note here, which I found absolutely amazing, is that we think of the Civil War as the first chance of secession. But in fact, according to your book, the North talked about seceding, and Pickering talked about seceding many, many years earlier.
Yes. The whole government was very porous at the edges. You know, we had the British still out in the West in indeterminate territories, and as well as in Canada. We had the Spanish at first in Louisiana, and then we had the French. And we had all of those countries, all three countries in the Caribbean. And various people, for various motives at various times, schemed with one or other of these countries. The first to do it were the people near the Mississippi, on the other side of the mountain, who wanted a vent out that way. When they thought that the federal government was going to make a bargain with Spain that would deny them navigation rights, that was the first threat. Then the rebellions in the north were the second threat. And Timothy Pickering, when the Louisiana Purchase went through, said, the slave power is taking over the government. We're not going to have any say in it, so let's secede. And his partners and friends up there said, we can't. It won't work. So nothing came of that. And then, of course, in 1798, Jefferson and Madison, in response to the Alien and Sedition Law, took a first step towards seceding when they said, well, we'll nullify. And, of course, Calhoun later said that. The threat of secession and the threat of disunion was there from the outset. The society, in 1800, about a fifth of the population was on the other side of the Appalachian and other mountain chain, and living pretty much free of the others, seeking their economic advantage out through New Orleans, Mobile. And that's why Aaron Burr thought that he could organize those people to be separate. There were adventurers and schemers all through this period. Burr was just one of them. The idea that the Republic was a settled, stable, eternal thing had not really sunk in. So each of these was a kind of hairbreadth rescue. One of the things that's so fascinating about the whole thing is that it could easily have gone the other way. You know, the Constitution just squeaked by. It could easily have failed. It would have failed except for certain things. It would have failed except for the Three-Fifths Clause. It would have failed except for Washington. Washington was absolutely essential to the adoption of the Constitution. It might have failed if some people had been a little more successful in the northern states in resisting it. It might have failed if Madison had not pacified so many people with the Bill of Rights. It might have failed if any of these secession attempts had come through. So it's really a perils of Pauline history that we had.